I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Mourners are gathered outside the funeral home in Santa Monica, California, where late President Ronald Reagan's body today began its final journey. The body will also lie in repose today at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley to give visitors there a chance to pay their respects as Washington, D.C. prepares for its first state funeral in 30 years this Friday at Washington's National Cathedral. The president's body will then be returned to California for burial. We spoke with Reagan Administration Deputy Chief of Staff and longtime friend Michael Deaver about Reagan's place in history.
Well, I hope history will remember him well. I think that you have seen, or we have seen, recently in the last 5 years, sort of a reevaluation of Reagan. I hope that history will say, you know, he ended the Cold War. I hope they'll say he restored confidence in America and a belief in ourselves again after a period of, not only Vietnam and Watergate, but the malaise of the 70s. So I think history will be good to him.
What's your fondest memory of Ronald Reagan?
Oh, there are so many. I think it's sort of the general impression of him as the kindest human being I ever knew. There was not an unkindness in him, and he was as gracious to the gardener or the waiter as he was to the king and queen. He didn't treat anybody any differently.
You're right, in fact, that he may have treated the gardener and the waiter a little better.
That could be. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. And yet he wasn't unemotional. You write in your book that he had a temper.
He had a temper, and he had, a real breaking point when it came to emotion about valor and sacrifice and human emotion. But yes, he did have a temper, and it was the Irish in him, I guess. You didn't see it explode very often. I think I said in my book 5 or 6 times in the 25 years. But when he did, get out of the way.
Former Deputy Chief of Staff during the Reagan administration and longtime friend Michael Deaver. Well, it's hard to open the newspaper or turn on the radio or the television without hearing fond memories of the late president, the eternal optimist with a penchant for jelly beans. Post-Vietnam, post-Watergate, post-the-wear-your-sweater gas shortages of the 70s, he gave Americans a reason to be proud of their country. But while there's little doubt that Reagan captivated the electorate, converting many a Democrat to his Republican Party along the way, his legacy is far more complicated than that. Here's Professor Leo Rubuffo of George Washington University speaking earlier today.
You know, there's no doubt that President Reagan was a charming man, a brave man, an excellent non-hands-on president in a way, but all presidencies are complicated. I would say he gets partial credit for the end of the Cold War, but policies going back many, many years obviously play a role. The revitalization of the economy had its costs, including a very high recession, and including a dismantling of part of the welfare state. Whether we call that good or bad is a judgment call, but I think we have to recognize that there is this complexity.
Professor Leo Rubuffo of George Washington University. Well, joining us now is Professor Roger Porter, a former advisor to President Reagan and professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Welcome, Professor.
Delighted to be with you, Robin.
And as you well know, as Leo, Professor Rubuffo just said, history will judge. And some already have. When President Reagan is credited with the fall of the Iron Curtain or the revitalization of the American economy, his detractors say the Soviet Union was falling under its own weight. President Reagan drove up an unnecessary defense budget that almost collapsed the U.S. Your thoughts on those detractors' thoughts?
Well, the Cold War was, in fact, a long twilight struggle that lasted several decades. But it's important to remember that when Ronald Reagan entered office in January of 1981, we had had sharply declining defense expenditures, and there was a real need to rebuild our defense establishment in order that we might negotiate from what he called a position of strength. And I think the verdict of history is unquestioned that in part because of his determination in seeing that through, the Soviet Union collapsed. Now, whether that would have occurred anyway is anyone's best guess, but he certainly played a leading role in fashioning a relationship with Mikhail Gorbachev, the fourth Soviet leader that he ended up dealing with, that led to the events of the early, late 1989 and early 1990s and the collapse of the Soviet Empire. Mm-hmm. With respect to the economy, he inherited a very challenging situation. 2 years of back-to-back double-digit inflation, rising unemployment, what economists refer to as stagnation or stagflation, and 21.5% interest rates. And he took a very sharp deep recession in 1981-82 to wring inflation out of the economy. But then, starting in 1982, we had 8 years of sustained economic growth, one of the longest periods in our nation's history, in large part because of the policies that he put into place.
Do you agree, though, with some of the critics who, and Leo Rebuffo is one of them, he writes in a Reader's Companion to American History on Ronald Reagan that while he did reshape American politics, his administration gutted some Great Society anti-poverty programs, accepted a deep recession in order to curb inflation, and sharply reduced income taxes in the higher brackets, the idea that, you know, things might have looked good, but it might have been on the backs of the poor?
Well, when Ronald Reagan came into office, the marginal tax rate on upper-income individuals was 70%, and the top 1% of income taxpayers were paying 17.9%, roughly 18% of all the income taxes that were being paid. Mm-hmm. When Ronald Reagan left office, he had cut, along with the Congress, marginal tax rates on the top level from 70% down to 50% and then on down to 28%. And when he left office, the top 1% of income taxpayers were paying 26% of the total income taxes that were being paid. Now, you say, how could this happen? But Ronald Reagan believed sharply that people were driven by incentives, and that if you're taxing people at a 70% marginal tax rate, then they're going to go into shelters and do all sorts of things that will try to help them avoid taxes. I can remember being in meeting after meeting after meeting with him in which he would say, now what are we getting that top rate down? And then he would regale us with stories about when he was in his acting career and the top marginal income tax rate was 91%, and then he was paying another 5 or 6% on top of that, that he would essentially stop working in mid-April or early May because he had been pushed into the highest bracket. So he felt very personally the importance of getting that top marginal rate down.
Well, and as you know, these are the things that are going to be debated. But when he did have a failing and admitted to it, he did so with the same charm that he addressed everything. Let's listen to him speaking right after the Iran-Contra scandal.
It's obvious that the execution of these policies was flawed and mistakes were made. I know the stories of the past few weeks have been distressing. I'm deeply disappointed this initiative has resulted in such a controversy, and I regret it's caused such concern and consternation. But I pledge to you, I will set things right.
Professor Porter, we just have a few seconds left. Do you think any president since has been able to address the American people in the way that he did?
Well, President Reagan was a marvelous communicator and had the capacity to state things in a way that the average citizen listening could understand. And I think that's one of his greatest legacies. And he also was very forthright and honest and candid with people. And I think that's what individuals look for in a leader. And in that respect, we've really had no equal before or since. John Kennedy was a marvelous communicator, as was Bill Clinton. The three of them, along with Ronald Reagan, have given us great presidents as communicators.
Well, Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Professor Roger Porter teaches at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University.
In Iraq today, 9 major political parties agreed to disband their militias, but the militia of radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr was not one of them. In the southern city of Kufa, an ammunition dump used by al-Sadr's forces reportedly caught fire today, killing at least one person. And at the United Nations, the fourth draft of a Security Council resolution on Iraq is almost ready for a vote. One of the last sticking points was how the U.S. and Iraq might have a military partnership from here on in. Joining us on the line from UN headquarters in New York is NPR reporter Linda Fasulo. Linda, welcome.
Hello. Hi. My pleasure.
Linda, this partnership plan was introduced just last night in a Security Council meeting. Why was it so important to reaching agreement on this resolution?
Well, what happened yesterday was the United States and Iraq exchanged letters basically pledging that they would reach agreement on controlling sensitive military operations, after the transfer of power on June 30th. This has been a sticking point here at the UN in the Security Council because various countries, particularly France, Germany, and to a lesser extent China, have been pushing for any new U.S. draft resolution to specifically state what the military relationship between the Iraqi interim government and the United States would be. And so the United States and Iraq wrote these letters to help address that issue.
And so how would that work exactly?
The letters do not sort of detail in any great extent exactly how the relationship will function, other than it makes it clear that Iraq will control, you know, its own forces, and that when it comes to controversial operations, for example, ones that Iraq may not be interested in participating or be interested in approving, such as the controversial operation in Fallujah, it makes it clear that the two sides will work together and coordinate and, try to work it out among themselves. However, France is still being a stickler and wants to ensure that the new resolution specifically states that Iraq's consent would be needed for any controversial operation.
Well, other than the concerns of the French, is the resolution about ready for a vote now, or are there still points that have to be negotiated?
I would say the resolution is very, very near approval, except for this sticking point. However, when I spoke with a senior American official earlier this morning, he indicated that the United States does not expect that this French demand will give them, as he said, great heartburn. He said it may not be exactly, the wording may not be exactly what the French would want, but it seems as if a major decision has been made at the very top between Chirac and Bush, and so that it's just a question of working out the wording.
And so perhaps a vote as early as tomorrow?
Well, at the UN, things always seem to get pushed back a little. One of the American diplomats told me today, we're hoping for tomorrow night, which is Tuesday night. But, in UN speak, that could mean Wednesday.
Linda, thank you.
My pleasure.
Linda Fasulo reports on the United Nations for National Public Radio. We spoke to her from UN headquarters in New York.
Just ahead, details come to light about a Pentagon memo offering a legal justification for the torture of prisoners.
And later in the program, President Bush travels to the G8 summit in Georgia.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Details have come to light about a Pentagon memo prepared for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld offering a legal justification for torturing prisoners, or as some have interpreted it, providing the legal loopholes for getting away with torture. The memo argues interrogators can claim a Nuremberg defense, in other words, say that they were just following orders, and it also gives the president the full legal authority to allow torture. The Wall Street Journal reported today on the memo, which was completed last year as the war on Iraq was unfolding. Reporter Jess Braven joins us on the line from New York. Jess, why did this memo come about? What prompted it?
Basically, in late 2002, they were dealing with recalcitrant prisoners in Guantanamo who they had very strong suspicions knew about 9/11 or were otherwise very closely connected to al-Qaeda plots, and they were getting nothing out of them. So a number of interrogators there began using very aggressive techniques, and some of those things began to work, the Pentagon said, but some of the lawyers in the military were uncomfortable with them. So as a result, the commander went to Defense Secretary Rumsfeld and said, we need some clarification about what the line is. And Rumsfeld had the chief lawyer at the Pentagon convene this working group to look at these legal issues and also come up with a series of interrogation techniques that would comply with the legal analysis.
Were there any specific forms of torture that were discussed in the memo?
Well, the memo did two things. It's subtle in some ways. It talked about, you know, what torture would be under the law as we understand it, and then a separate portion dealt with, of course, if you were not going to comply with that law, here are your defenses to any accusation that you had disregarded it. So it talks about what level of pain is necessary to be considered torture, and it goes into some detail into various dictionary and legal and psychological definitions, that it must be severe pain, pain that is so intense that it is impossible to bear. And any pain would not constitute torture. The use of drugs or other mind-altering substances or techniques, that's okay as long as it does not doesn't shatter the very core of your identity or perception of the world.
You quote a military official who said that this came about after frustrated Guantanamo interrogators were trying to figure out how to ratchet up the pressure, as you write, and how somebody had to rethink the whole approach to defending the country when an enemy doesn't follow the rules. How does that square with what experts are telling us about the use of torture, that it doesn't really work in getting information?
Well, that's the that's the company line on torture, that it doesn't work. And in fact, 2 years ago, I spent a couple days at the U.S. Army's interrogation school at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and that's right. The instructors tell the students that torturing someone doesn't work, because if that simply gives the subject the incentive to say anything he thinks the interrogator wants to hear, just to make it stop. It's not reliable, they say. And that is the official position of the Army and in the Army field manuals that discuss interrogation methods. But clearly, there are some instances in which interrogators feel that general rule might not apply. And that's what today's story was really about, the legal structure surrounding those harsher interrogation methods.
Jess, thank you.
Sure thing.
Jess Braven, reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
It's no secret Americans are fat and getting fatter. A new national report shows Americans consider childhood obesity to be as serious a problem as smoking and school violence. And a Yale University School of Medicine study suggests that obese children have an increased risk of developing diabetes and heart disease. One state has taken measures to combat obesity in school-age kids. Arkansas has released results from its first round of mandatory statewide testing of body fat in children. Last year, Arkansas became the first state in the country to require that testing in public schools, after learning that its school children were among the most overweight in the country. The results suggest that the national epidemic of childhood obesity is even worse than we thought. Joining us on the line is Dr. Joe Thompson. He is director of the Arkansas Center for Health Improvements. Welcome, doctor.
Welcome to you. Thank you for the opportunity.
And tell us, what have you learned?
Previously, the national estimates and estimates for our state suggested that as many as 30% of Arkansas children could either be overweight or at risk of becoming overweight. We found that 40% of Arkansas's children are in one of these two risk categories.
So this isn't something that you did with the calipers, as many of us might be familiar with. You did it solely on height and weight, and then that somewhat complicated formula that you used to determine it?
Right. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that every child every year have their BMI, or body mass index, assessed. It only requires height and weight, and whether it's a boy or a girl and how old the child is, to come up with a quantitative assessment of whether the child is at risk for being overweight or is in the heaviest category, being overweight.
Well, once you've identified these children who are obese, what does the state do then?
We have already eliminated vending machines in every public elementary school across the nation. We have established parent advisory committees in every one of the 300 school districts across the state. Other activities that we have underway include nutrition and physical activity recommendations that are going to the Board of Education, as well as engagement of clinical providers to make sure that they're prepared to assist parents who have a positive screen that their child may be overweight. One of the things that we're finding as we've done pilot community work is that many of our parents welcome this information and previously were not aware that their child was in a risk category.
Well, in certain ages, it's tempting to just say, oh, well, you know, their height's going to catch up with their weight at some point, right?
Well, and that's what the BMI allows. Where previously parents did have the height and the weight alone, the BMI is adjusted for how old the child is and whether they're a boy or a girl. So it takes into account the differential growth rates and provides a much more accurate assessment of whether the child is getting into trouble.
And is this the sort of program that you expect other states will pick up as well?
Because we will assess every child every year, we will be able to follow those interventions, if you will, and do other interventions at the community and the school level and see what works. As we learn from our experience, we look forward to sharing with other states so that we can broaden the effort to combat child and adolescent obesity.
Dr. Thompson, thank you.
Thank you, and have a good afternoon.
Dr. Joe Thompson is director of the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement. Us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Sea Island, Georgia is one of the most exclusive zip codes in the country, right up there with Palm Beach and Aspen. And this week, it's the site of an international summit hosted by President Bush. Against a backdrop of gorgeous beaches and stately trees draped with Spanish moss, leaders of the group of eight industrialized nations are supposed to talk economic policy, but they'll primarily be focused on Iraq and the Middle East. And they're meeting during a week of national mourning for the late President Ronald Reagan. Joining us on the line to talk about the week ahead in politics is Andrea Stone, who covers Congress for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi there.
And Bill Douglas, who covers the White House for Knight Ridder Newspapers and who's joining us from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
We're fine. How are you, more importantly? You must be pretty tired because I understand you were traveling with the president in Europe and then flew into Savannah and just came from a White House morning briefing. What are they saying about the week ahead?
Well, it's a pretty busy agenda this week. This summit normally does deal mostly with economic matters, but Iraq's the name of the game this week, and the U.S. is going to try to reach consensus on a U.N. resolution, which could happen as early as tomorrow.
And also, I don't know if you've been down to Sea Island yet, but you probably know you reach it through a causeway. What does its selection as a site for this meeting tell us about the security precautions?
As all summits are in the 21st century, protesters can get there if they can swim. I mean, that's the general theme of this. They want this as far from a downtown area, from an area where people can get to as possible for security purposes. We're a good chunk of change away from where the summit will actually occur. I mean, our exposure as reporters to the world leaders is minimal. I mean, we will be relying on briefings, conference calls, and the like. They just don't want people around.
And I assume that includes ordinary Georgians. You expect to see any of them.
Ordinary Georgians, ordinary folks. It's just really difficult to get to where the action actually is.
And, Bill, let's look back for just a moment, if we can, to this weekend with President Bush on site in Europe. I'm wondering if you felt that he scored any political points in Italy and France over the weekend, particularly when he compared going into Iraq with what had happened with the liberation that occurred as a result of World War II.
Well, with Italy, he really didn't need to score political points with the government. I mean, he and Berlusconi are relatively tight. The Italian public, they're a bit of a mixed bag. They actually became more supportive of the war after some Italian forces were killed. France is a totally different story. President Bush and President Chirac met, had a news conference where they professed that everything was fine, but the minute questions were asked, you could tell that there were still some relatively stark differences. President Chirac made a point of saying how equating the war in Iraq to World War II and Allied cooperation was a bit of a false argument. He said history does not repeat itself. Consequently, the president did not make that point that strongly at Normandy, at the Normandy celebration. I mean, I think in part because of President Reagan's passing.
And Andrea Stone, of course, the death of President Reagan really overshadowed that 60th anniversary observance for many people. And in fact, we're told that President Bush may even briefly leave the summit on Sea Island to greet Reagan's body as it arrives in Washington. How do you see this playing in terms of politics? Because we understand this week John Kerry's canceling all of his events.
That's right. There's no competition here. I think he figured that the best thing was just to just get out of sight. And he wasn't going to get a whole lot of attention anyway because he's down there in Sea Island with all the world leaders. So he came out and he did speak about President Reagan and said some very nice things about him. You know, even though he said that he didn't always agree with him, especially on domestic policy, he was always a source of inspiration in terms of the optimism and his outlook, which you're hearing a lot about this week. Washington hasn't seen a state funeral like this since Lyndon Johnson's over 30 years ago. The last president to die was Richard Nixon, and the services were held out in California for him. So it's going to be, you know, this week in Washington, there's a major construction project going on to build a visitor center at the Capitol, which is why usually visitors in this kind of situation would enter from the east side of the Capitol, but that's a total construction site, so people who want to see the body laying in state, the casket laying in state, will have to come in through the west side. And on top of that, Washington's full of tourists, for the first time I've seen since 9/11. So it's going to be, Friday is going to be a day of mourning. You don't want to be in your car if you're a Washingtonian on Friday because there's going to be motorcades, and it's just going to be a mess.
Actually, yes, a national day of mourning. They're expecting, I understand the U.S. Capitol Police are bracing for some 100,000 people to come through and pay their respects.
Right, and we are in the post 9/11 world, so security is always a concern. Homeland Security Department is treating this as a special event, sort of like the conventions will be in terms of a terrorism alert and precautions. So I think this will be different from past times when somebody has laid in state, like President Kennedy, for instance, in 1963, because there is this new layer of security fears.
There was an interesting quote from former Vice President Walter Mondale, who got trounced by Reagan in 1984. 49 states went for Reagan. Only one went for Mondale, his home state. And he said that, unlike today, that there was no meanness in that campaign. Certainly doesn't seem to be the case now, does it?
No. Reagan will be remembered for so many things. One thing is that he really gave birth to the modern Republican Party, the conservative Republican Party, and really was the death knell for the so-called moderate Rockefeller Republicans. He also was the first one who really kind of tapped into the religious right. And I think that those helped to contribute to sort of the polarization that we have seen, really since Bill Clinton and now under this President Bush. There is a meanness, people, the accolades about President Reagan that are coming out from people who, when he was president, people are forgetting that he was a very divisive president. Not everybody loved him, like you're hearing today. But everybody agrees, John Kerry on down, that he always had an air of optimism and he wasn't somebody who made you angry.
And Bill Douglas, what's the discussion where you are about Ronald Reagan? And do you see his passing overshadowing this G8 summit to some extent?
His passing won't overshadow the summit because there's so many serious things they have to contend with, particularly Iraq. He's being spoken of in high regard here as a great president. As you said, a president who did exude optimism and who was not particularly mean-spirited. I mean, you can't get eight leaders from the world's biggest countries to come here and not do anything. So they recognize they have to balance that out, and they will do that. They'll pay their respects, and then they'll get busy.
Andrea, thank you.
My pleasure.
Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
Andrea Stone covers Congress for USA Today. She joined us from Washington. And Bill Douglas covers the White House for Knight Ridder newspapers. He joined us from Savannah, Georgia.
Still to come, the sophisticated sounds of Henry Mancini, the music many baby boomers rejected as kids, is growing on them as they grow older.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Tonight and early Tuesday morning, Venus will pass between the Earth and Sun for the first time since 1882. Perhaps someone will honor this week's occasion with music, as composer John Philip Sousa did back then. Transit of Venus March, written during the 1982 celebration of what Edmund Halley called by far the noblest sight that astronomy affords. It's also an infrequent one. This planetary alignment placing Venus between the Earth and the Sun will happen again in 2012, and then not for another 100 years. Rich Talcott is the senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. Rich, what is the importance of this transit?
Well, today it's not as super important as it was back in the 19th century. Today, what most people are interested in is just being able to watch as Venus tracks across the face of the Sun on Tuesday morning. Mm-hmm. But back in the 19th and 18th centuries, what people were interested in was to figure out the scale of the solar system, to figure out how far Venus was from Earth and how far the Sun was from Earth, which was something that scientists didn't know very accurately at all. And watching these transits of Venus allowed them to figure it out.
And in later years, there was a use of modern technology to actually calculate the distance using radar signals?
Right. Today, we can bounce radar signals off of many of the other planets and figure out these positions extremely accurately. But back in the 18th and 19th centuries, there wasn't any way to get it more accurate than a few thousand miles at best.
Well, so there's the scientific importance, but also it's really cool, I imagine. I mean, no one's alive who's seen it, but it's, what is it, a black dot that crosses over the Sun?
Yeah, it'll look just like a black dot, almost like a sunspot if anyone has ever gone out and taken a look at the Sun at other times with proper protection on their eyes, for their eyes.
Mm. And we should say we want to offer our apologies to our listeners in, oh, say, southern Chile and most of the west of the United States who can't see it because of the timing.
That's right. It turns out that the East Coast is the best spot in the United States to see it because we're going to be able to see about the last 2 hours or so of the event. But as you get farther and farther west in the United States, because this is occurring at sunrise, and sunrise occurs later the farther west you go, they're going to be able to see less and less of it. And by the time you get to the mountain states and the Pacific Coast, it won't be visible at all.
And remind us how you do it. I mean, don't look directly at the Sun, but how can you see this?
Right. The best way to do it is to either get a pair of eclipse glasses. These are the same kinds of things that people use to observe eclipses of the Sun, where you run into the same problems of staring directly at the Sun. Or you can buy solar filters that will allow you to take a look at the Sun without any problem.
How did they do it back in the day, 100 years ago?
What they used to do was to project an image through a telescope. So instead of looking through the telescope itself, the telescope would project an image of the Sun onto a piece of paper. And people can still do that if they happen to own a telescope. It's still a very easy method to try.
Or if you remember from third grade, you make a little pinhole in the box. And what do? You project it onto a piece of paper?
Right. The best thing to do is take a shoebox or a larger cardboard box and cut a fairly large hole in one side and then put a piece of aluminum foil over it and put a little pinprick into that. And what will happen is the sunlight will pass through that pinprick and onto the opposite side of the box on the inside. You take a look at that and it shows a small but nice view of the Sun.
Rich, thanks so much.
Glad to do it.
Rich Talcott, senior editor for Astronomy Magazine.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
If you're just joining us, here's the latest news this hour. Former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev will be among the mourners at the funeral service this Friday for former President Ronald Reagan. The two became friends and helped preside over the end of the Cold War. Earlier in our program, we heard from former Reagan aide Michael Deaver about the Reagan legacy.
Well, I hope history will remember him well. I think that you have seen, or we have seen, in the last 5 years, sort of a reevaluation of Reagan. I hope that history will say, you know, he ended the Cold War. I hope they'll say he restored confidence in America and a belief in ourselves again after a period of not only Vietnam and Watergate, but the malaise of the 70s. I think history will be good to him.
Michael Deaver served as Deputy Chief of Staff during the Reagan years. Also, attorneys for Martha Stewart are filing for a new trial, which delays her sentencing from June 17th to July 8th.
Sometimes it's so simple. When a song is powerful and memorable, it's the melody. From the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's, one of the most recorded songs in music history with over 1,000 different versions. Here's one of the more recent, Stevie Wonder on harmonica, take 6 on vocals. Is just one of hundreds of pieces written by the late composer Henry Mancini, who died 10 years ago this month at the age of 70, and whose life is being celebrated this year. The U.S. Postal Service has introduced a new Mancini postage stamp, and the recording industry is celebrating as well with several new Mancini-related CDs. Joining us in the studio to talk about some of them is Here and Now jazz aficionado James Isaacs. Hello, James.
Hi, Robin.
I have to mention right away, there is actually a Moon River. You have driven across it.
I have crossed Moon River. Moon River is outside of Savannah, Georgia. I didn't find any Huckleberry friends on any of my crossings. But it is quite picturesque as you're going from downtown Savannah out to the island.
Well, you make the point that just about everyone of a certain generation knows that song, knows the lyrics.
Johnny Mercer's lyric, by the way.
And he lived near the real Moon
River.
He's
from Savannah, yeah.
It's music that a generation adored and then that generation's children in part rejected, some of them did.
Elevator music.
Exactly.
M.O.R.
And now it seems the parents are getting their sweet revenge because here's this huge recognition again of Mancini's music.
Well, you know, Robin, kids have this odd way of turning into middle-aged people and then old folks. It just, I don't know how it happens. It wasn't all that long ago that I was, I don't know, 16.
And rejecting Henry Mancini,
well,
maybe.
Yeah, and here I am 73 or 4.
And not. What is it about the music, though, that is so enduring and that we are recognizing?
Well, because Henry Mancini was, among other things, the last great writer of traditional popular songs before the Beatles, before the English Invasion, before Bob Dylan and the Motown Stax Volt era took over on the radio. This is a guy who was nominated for 70 Grammys and won 20 of them. This is a guy who was nominated for 20 Academy Awards and won 4 of them. So this is a man of tremendous accomplishment. Mm. If you are a film buff, you know that Henry Mancini wrote the soundtrack to Orson Welles' wonderful film noir Touch of Evil. But it wasn't until the TV series Peter Gunn, which was masterminded by Blake Edwards, a guy with whom Mancini worked extensively over the course of both men's career, that Henry Mancini started to become widely known, and it was because of that theme.
Talk about new recordings that are just out this year, celebrating the life and work of Henry Mancini. There are 4 new CDs. We're going to talk about 2 of them. Start us off with one.
I'll start us off with The Ultimate Mancini, which is on the Concord Records label. In fact, the cover has a recreation of that 37-cent postage stamp to which you alluded merely moments ago. Mm-hmm. The Ultimate Mancini album is newly recorded versions of many of Mancini's signature songs. One of the performers is a very good singer named Monica Mancini, one of Henry Mancini's twin daughters. Days of Wine and Roses was the second song for which Henry Mancini won an Academy Award. Again, the lyricist is Johnny Mercer. Here is Monica Mancini from Ultimate Mancini.
The days of wine and roses laugh and run away like a child at play.
That's Days of Wine and Roses from the new CD, Ultimate Mancini. And there's a second CD, James, you want to highlight as well?
I do, and this is the RCA album called Midnight, Moonlight, and Magic, the very best of Henry Mancini. And the next piece that we'll hear is from his television soundtrack to a short-lived show, Mr. Lucky, starring John Vivian. Robin, there you heard the trombone section featured on the Mr. Lucky theme. Mancini, of course, grew up during the big band era, and there's yet another example of his versatility.
You know, we can hear it, we can feel it, but what is it about this music that makes it so special?
At times, the sophistication of it. In other cases, it's just the pure melodicism, if that's a word. At other times, it's the way that Mancini can bring in unusual hooks. For example, on a tune that we won't hear, Baby Elephant Walk from the film Hatari, a John Wayne movie. There's all this odd percussion and other unusual instruments. He just was someone who could bring in all kinds of elements as the situation dictated, like any great writer of film soundtracks could write to the cut. He could write to the action, the overall mood of the film, but he could do it in such a surpassing way.
And another memorable example of that is his theme to the Pink Panther. And you've reminded me, James, that there's a little Henry Mancini joke that goes along with it.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Dead aunt.
Dead aunt who?
Dead aunt. 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 That's the updated Pink Panther theme from Ultimate Mancini, and it features Plas Johnson on breathy tenor saxophone. Mancini said he wanted a combination of Lester Young's cool and Ben Webster's deep, breathy soulfulness, and he wanted a witty player as well, and he got all of those qualities in Plas Johnson's performance. Now, you can hear the original with Plas Johnson on tenor on Midnight, Moonlight, and Magic, the very best of Henry Mancini. You can also find it on another RCA reissue, The Ultimate Pink Panther. So, all over the place these days, Henry Mancini, his transcendent music, and it's been a pleasure talking about it to you, Robin.
Thank you, James. It's been a pleasure listening to it. Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. For more information on composer Henry Mancini, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. Thank you.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.